It's the 5th of February. Question? 5th of February. Now, if you weren't here on Tuesday, come up after class because I have these security types handout that you need to memorize. We discussed that on Tuesday, so contact me on that. Today, we get started on mutual funds. Oh, by the way, pass these around. Those of you who got a blank, I made extra copies, so pass the assignment sheets for Chapter 1. I apologize on that. One of the sides was blank for some of you. So if you've got a blank, take one and pass it around. And we're going to start mutual funds. Investments for the masses. But first we need a good joke. Anybody got a good joke? Nobody has a good joke. Did I tell you about the alligator that walked into the park?
Yeah.
And the bear?
Yeah.
And the mushroom?
Yeah.
I didn't tell you about the mushroom? Mm-hmm. Well, this mushroom walks into a bar. Have you guys heard this one before? No? And he orders a beer. And the bartender looks at him and says, Wait a minute. You're a mushroom. We don't serve your kind. And the mushroom says, no, you got me all wrong. I'm a fungi. You see, not a mushroom, he's a fungi. And did you get it? Yeah? Yeah, mastomenus. Fungi is also, it's fungus. Fungus. Mushrooms are fungus. Yeah, no. Jokes are the hardest things to translate. Jokes are the hardest things. Come on in, Elizabeth. Come on in. Okay, seat right over here. All right. Mutual funds. Dear students. Whoa. Oh, and we looked. Okay, remind me. After class, if you wanted to create your own portfolio, I'll stick around. I'll show you how to do it. It's pretty straightforward. But so far, everybody has kind of been a bit of a disappointment, except for Apple First Solar and $5 actually has done pretty well. But not so much. It's not much. Minus Google down a little bit. Caterpillar down a little bit. But hey, we're up. We've made $1,200 in just a couple of weeks. Not bad, huh? Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll watch this every time. Remind me. If I forget, just remind me. How are we doing? And you see, what they want you to do is they want you to do your own. But again, this to me, I don't like it because it condones short-term thinking. And I think that's not good for investors. But that's me.
Before you get started, you have commercial paper.
Commercial paper.
And
okay, commercial paper is something that we as most individual investors are just not going to get involved with. If you go to my website, you'll see, this is mostly for the online students, but you know, you guys can watch it too. I have lots of links to various things. And so here are some examples of commercial paper. Here you go. This is from a mutual fund company that owns commercial paper like their checking account, their cash account, because they have millions of dollars to invest. And so here are just some. There are many others. They don't show all of them. But here are some examples of commercial paper. Electricity of France, you know, the French electrical company. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. What are those guys? Mortgage, right. They're the overlords of the mortgage world. The Bank of Nova Scotia. The Nordea North America. I don't know what that is. But what these companies did is they issued IOUs. They said, look, you know, we need money for 90 days or 180 days or 270 days. We will sell you this security, commercial paper, at $95,000 each. And then that's a little low, maybe $98,000. And then in 6 months, we'll buy it back from you at $100,000. That's how it works. So what we see is the current value here. So here's the current value. For this one right here, they have $94,970. And what you got to do is you got to add three zeros. These are big numbers. They don't show. They show it's actually $94,970,000. And What's going to happen? Now, many of these, all, well, 212, many of these have already matured. They've already got their money back because these are short-term investments. And this is from the 30th of September. So we see that when these mature, this entity is going to get $95 million back. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's called the discount method. So we see the current value, and as we get closer and closer to the date that this commercial paper matures, we're going to get a higher value, a maturity value.
Okay, so that banker's acceptance...
Same thing. A banker's acceptance notes are the same thing, except the company that issued them just doesn't have the credit quality to do it, so they go to their bank. And they say, hey, Wells Fargo, hey, Bank of America, I need a loan for 90 days. I want to buy engines, or I need to buy something really big, and then I'm going to get my money back. Don't worry, I'll pay you back. But I'm not big enough to go to the commercial paper market and say, will you give me a loan? So they go to the bank, and the bank does it. Of course, the bank charges them a fee for that. But the banker's acceptance notes are the same idea. They just don't have the entities just don't have the same gravitas. They don't have the same reputation. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Have you been searching for them?
No.
No, okay, because they're not easy to find. They're not easy to find. Most people who buy commercial paper have a lot of money. They have their own personal brokers.
Are they like Donald Trump
and all that? Yeah, very, very wealthy individuals. But more people who use them are pensions and mutual fund companies and life insurance companies, companies that have billions of millions and billions of dollars to invest. And for them, $100,000 is no big deal. Make sense? They're not risky at all. They are short-term investments with very little risk. Because if one of these people go belly up, the whole world takes notice. And so, no, these are, what do we say about short-term investments? Low risk, no risk. Well, there's a little bit of risk. And low return. Look at the returns. Look at what they're paying. 0.18, 0.07. It's like your savings. Exactly. It's just like your savings account. A little bit better, because what is Wells Fargo paying you? 0.01? No thanks. Goofballs. Okay, so now let's get to work on mutual funds. And did I pass them out? I did, didn't I? Where the hell are they now? Where are the rest of them? Yeesh. Did you ever have one of those decades? What did I do with the extras? Oh boy. Not these. Oh, well, those of you who came in late, I'll have them. I gave them out, didn't I?
This?
Yeah. Bizarre. All right, let's get started. We got to get started on mutual funds. As I said, I'm a little logy, I'm a little slow. But mutual funds, indeed, dear students, mutual funds are investments for the masses. You see, before mutual funds came out, most individuals simply didn't own stocks. It just wasn't done. And you ever watch Downton Abbey? You ever watch Downton Abbey? The guy who writes that is a genius, and he loved that time. Because around 1910, 1920, the upper classes started to become lesser and lesser important, and the middle class was emerging. And the mutual funds were just one symptom of that emergence of the middle class. Whereas now, before, only gentlemen owned stocks. You know, the hoi polloi, the lower classes didn't own stocks. But mutual funds were a way for the masses to get involved in the global markets. What is a mutual fund? Well, a mutual fund is an investment company. There are other types of investment companies, but the biggest one, of course, is mutual funds. That's the legal term. You will not hear people use that term unless you're in the industry. The legal term is mutual fund, is investment company. Everybody else uses mutual fund. You get two wonderful things. Professional money management. These people are supposed to know what they're doing. And some are very good and some are not so good. And you get instant diversification, which allows the common man and woman to invest in a broad base of securities, stocks, bonds, whatever, and reap the benefits of that, because if one company goes bad, oh well. Each fund has a specific objective, and there are over 10,000 of these things. Did you add Nathan last night? Nathan?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, good. 10,000 mutual funds. Are there 10,000 different types of breakfast cereal in the grocery store? It seems like it, doesn't it? No, it's not. Yes? Oh, okay. We're going to discuss the objectives. This mutual fund invests in stocks. This mutual fund invests in bonds. And then what's happened is that it's exploded. This mutual fund invests in stocks based in Norway. This mutual fund invests in stocks that begin with the letter H. This mutual—I mean, it's gotten ridiculous, as we'll see. Why are mutual funds so important? Well, you, dear students, when you walk out into the workaday world, chances are you're going to have a retirement plan that is sponsored by your employer, 401k, 403b. That will have mutual funds as the choices of investment. And for that reason alone, this chapter is probably the most important chapter for you all semester long. But we're going to get past mutual funds, and you're going to see what's underneath them. And some people, what they do, and some books, they teach mutual funds after we get through stocks, bonds, and then other people, myself included in this book, does it before. And I think there's advantages to both, and there's problems with both. We're going to see that as we go through, we're going to have terms that we won't discuss until we get to Chapter 5 on stocks and get to Chapter 9 on bonds. But be that as it may, this is how we're pulling it off. Here's my, aren't you proud of me? Here's my graphic. I made this all myself. You're not proud of that? Look at those stick figures. Now, aren't those cool stick figures? Here we are, dear students. We're the little people. And we give our $50, $100 a month to the mutual fund company, more if we can afford it. And the people with the top hats, these are women, by the way, and more investors are women, because women are realizing that they need to take care of themselves, because they saw their grandmother and their mother, or maybe whatever, defer to the man of the house, who said, "Don't worry, little lady, I'll take care of everything." And he was a bozo and never saved a dime. And then he died. And now grandma's penniless. So women are... You see, I don't know about you guys, but women are taking over the world. It's about time. It's about time. And they've already got some machines to do the heavy work. You know, it used to be you had to have guys around to do the heavy work, but now you got machines to do that. And you used to need to have guys to do, you know, to help with propagating the species, right? You need a guy and a gal, right? That's how it works, in case you didn't notice. But you might also notice that one ejaculation has 300 million sperm. So they don't need too many of us. So remember that, guys. You know, be good to the ladies. And so they give the money to the people in the top hats. And notice that more and more of them are women, because it turns out the women make better investors. It's already been statistically shown that women are better investors than men. Now, I'll leave it to you to decide why. What's the reason? What's the reason? We'll discuss later on maybe one of the reasons. That's right. As George said, they're more conservative. Men tend to look at investing like football or baseball. They're going to throw the Hail Mary pass. They're going to swing for the fences. What happens, you MIP sports fans, when you swing for the fences? You strike out an awful lot, don't you? Exactly. Whereas women are, you know, they like singles. Okay, I think we get singles. When I get on base, I don't know. If that helps, great. If it doesn't, forget it. And what they do is they create a pool of money. A mutual fund. That's the tense of the word, mutual fund. And then with that pool of money, they buy stocks, in which case it's a stock mutual fund. If they buy bonds, it's a bond mutual fund. If they buy short-term investments, such as the commercial paper that we just saw, then it's a money market mutual fund. But what happens to the mutual fund? Do people say money market mutual fund? No, they just say money market. And then what we start to see is the bifurcation, which is a fancy way of splitting up, saying splitting up. Splitting up of the world, because there are balance funds that invest in both stocks and bonds. And that's just the beginning. And we'll deal with that next week, the different types. Okay, now, what's happened? In 1940, there were 70 mutual funds. Mutual funds actually started in the 1920s. They were taken in the United States from the Scottish Unit Investment Trust, they were called. And when these things came out, there was a very uneasiness about them, because never before did the government and the regulators see these things. They didn't know what to do with them. Normally, when you're an entity, whether you're an individual or a corporation, and you make money, the IRS says, ooh, excuse me, you understand? But the mutual fund said, no, you don't understand. We're making money for our investors. We're not doing it for ourselves. I mean, we charge our investors a fee, but we're not out there making the money for ourselves. You need to tax the investors. And the IRS, you know, and the state regulators, they were a little bit messy. They didn't know what to do. So in 1940, we had the Investment Company Act. And it's a tremendous landmark piece of legislation that shows that the demagogues and the Republic rats, they can talk to one another. They can work it out. They've done it in the past. They can do it in the future. And it stood the test of time. And at the time, there were just 70. 30 years later, there were 350. 600, 2,000, and then in the 1990s, the market went hyperkinetic. It went in two directions, up and way up, and we wound up with 9,000, and now at the end of 2013, right, at the end of 2013, 10,905 mutual funds. And what we're going to see when we discuss this next week is that choosing one is just, it's not easy. It is really not easy. You're just, it's an explosion. You're overwhelmed. People have this deer in the headlights stare. In 1980, there were 5 million Americans who owned mutual funds, holding just 3% of household financial assets. As of December 2013, 96 million Americans, that was 330 million Americans, 320, owned mutual funds in 56.7 million households. That's about 46%, not quite half of the households in the United States own mutual funds. Why? As we said, when you go out into the workaday world, chances are you're going to be thrust in your face this employer-sponsored plan for your retirement, because the old traditional pension plans, they're going away. The employers don't want to deal with them anymore. They want you to take charge. Mutual funds are now the nation's largest financial intermediary, $17 trillion. That means they are bigger in terms of what they hold for other people than commercial banks and life insurance companies. Life insurance companies are often called the invisible bankers. So this industry is very large, very profitable. That's why there's 10,000 of them. And they have a lot of power, a lot of influence. pulled, why do we buy them? What are the big advantages? Well, somewhere in your description on the exam, and no problem. And when you discuss, when someone says, what is a mutual fund? What you want to say is, at the very least, you want to mention these two items. The diversification that you get when you invest in a mutual fund. You put $50 in the mutual fund, and you get 25 cents of IBM, and 50 cents of Walmart, and 40 cents of JCPenney's. You with me? Can you go out and buy 50 cents of a company?
No.
Well, you can through your mutual fund. And this variety provides some safety that is difficult for an individual to investor to obtain on their own, because what if you bought Kodak? Remember Kodak? The name is going to live forever for a long time, but the company is gone, right? Basically gone. There's a couple pieces of it that survived, but Kodak's gone. And you don't remember Kodak because you guys are too young, but everybody used to buy those little yellow boxes of film, what? And the disposable cameras, and you bought the film and you put it in your camera. Do you guys remember that? You do? Okay. But who has film anymore?
Polaroids.
Yeah, they went first. They went in 98. Polaroid used to be one of the nifty 50 in 1970s. That you never would lose money if you invested in it. But I always thought it wasn't a good idea to invest in a company whose name rhymes with hemorrhoid. I just don't think that's a good idea. Polaroid, hemorrhoid. And then we said the professional money manager, the people in the top hats. They get paid very, very well, folks. You might think, I want to be a mutual fund manager. Okay, one of the things you never want to do if you want to be a mutual fund manager is put Southwestern College on your resume, okay? After you've gone to Harvard or Yale or Stanford, just make sure you don't put Southwestern, because they'll look... And the cool thing about mutual funds is that you don't need a lot of money. $50 a month, $25 a month, can you get started? People will say, well, I don't know if I can invest. You know, I don't have a lot of money. I say, can you afford $50 a month? And they go, ooh. I say, how much is your cell phone payment? They go, well, it's supposed to be 40, but it winds up being 80. I download a lot of ringtones. So can you put $50 a month away?
Yeah.
Now, some of you just starting out, you're still in school, not yet, but in a couple of years, yeah. Yeah, sure.
So if I go to my
If you go to your bank, what's going to happen is the bank teller is going to say, oh, here, come on over to this part of the bank, and it'll say, investments. And even though you're still in the bank, you're no longer dealing with the bank. Instead of dealing with Wells Fargo, you're dealing with Wells Fargo advisors. Instead of dealing with Mission Federal Credit Union, you're now dealing with credit unions, securities organization, I forget the name, CUSO. So you see, it's a sister company because the bank can't get involved with this. The bank is guaranteed by the full faith and credit of an agency of the federal government. So mutual funds are not guaranteed. So you are now dealing with a different entity. And what they've done is studied the people who, you know, it's okay, Wells Fargo, all right. They've signed up, and all the literature, and I'm going to show you some of it, it says, this is not guaranteed by a bank or any other entity, so you may lose money. Be afraid, be very afraid. It's like, you know, Gregorian chant. And yet, they sign up, and then 6 months later, they call them. Now, did you invest with Wells Fargo? Oh, yes, yes. And is your you bought a mutual fund? Oh, yes, I did, for my Roth IRA. And now, is your investment guaranteed? Oh, yes, it's a guaranteed. It's a bank. It's guaranteed. See, people believe what they want to believe. Did I answer your question?
Well, my actual question is, where, so if I wanted to get like a good one, I have to go like to a financial, like a Merrill Lynch guy or something like that?
Maybe yes, maybe no. Hold on, George. We'll talk about more about how to choose a mutual fund later on.
Yeah, that was my question.
Yeah, it's not easy. And then lastly, the PETA factor. Now, I didn't come up with this. I wish I did. But this is from the Wealthy Barber. And what does PETA stand for? Pain in the... The cool thing about mutual funds is that once you've chosen the mutual fund, or funds, if you want to buy a few, there's really nothing for you to do. They do the work for you. And I have a renewed appreciation for the easiness of mutual funds after having gotten invested in real estate. I got to tell you, the PETA factor for real estate is way up there.
But didn't Goldstein have a huge deal when the market crashed?
Everybody took his huge hit in 2008. Everybody. Nobody was spared, except for Treasury bonds. That was the only one. Okay, what are the drawbacks? Well, guess what? Are they doing this for their health, folks, the mutual fund companies? Everyone should say no. Wait till I ask you. Are they doing it for their health?
No,
they are for-profit entities, and there are transaction costs that we'll discuss, loads. Some are no loads. That's a fancy word, not even a fancy word, for sales charge, commission. But every mutual fund, no matter what it is, has annual operating expenses. And this, more than the transaction costs, are what we want to deal with, and we'll just spend quite a bit of time on these. And it turns out that many mutual funds don't match the market's performance. What? Aren't the mutual fund managers supposed to know what they're doing? They're certainly getting paid well enough. Why wouldn't they match? Well, we'll discuss some of the problems as we continue. Now, most people never know about the difference between open-end and closed-end. But you, as Introduction to Investment students, and if you ever go on to take the Series 7 or the Series 6 for life insurance folks, you need to know the difference. Most mutual funds are open-ended or open-end mutual funds. These, by far, are the greatest majority. This investment company, this type of mutual fund, the investor buys shares from the mutual fund, sells shares back, and they want to get their money back at any time. Shares are issued and redeemed by the investment company at the request of the investors. So at any time you call a mutual fund company, I want to buy more shares, no problem. What they do is they create more shares, take your money, and they do all the accounting. And when you want your money back, you just say, I want, you know, $1,000, whatever. They sell sufficient number of shares. It confuses people when they look at their statement because they see a dollar amount, but they also see the number of shares. And they see the share price bounce up and down, and that's how their dollar amount changes. When people refer to a mutual fund, they are almost exclusively referring to open-ended mutual funds. As of December 13, there were how many? Almost 9,000 of these were open-end, totaling $15 trillion. And remember, there's only $17 trillion in the mutual fund industry, so that's the lion's share of money. And notice how 2013 was a pretty darn good year. $13 trillion at the end of 2012, $15 trillion at the end of 2014. So that was the end of 2013. That was a very good year. Closed-end mutual funds, on the other hand, are very different. The mutual fund company issues a fixed number of shares, 10 million shares, or 100 million, or however many. They issue a certain number of shares. Once those shares have been purchased by the initial investors, you don't go to the mutual fund company to buy your shares. You go to your broker and you say, I'd like to buy 100 shares of this closed-end mutual fund. And what you do is you incur brokerage commissions. They're not as popular and they're becoming less popular. At the end of 2013, there were only 600 of these, holding only $279 billion. So $15 trillion in open-end, $279 in closed-end. $279 billion. Are you with me? You see that huge difference? And notice that the number had shrunken the number had shrunken from 1 year to the another, to the other. So these are disappearing. The closed-end mutual funds are going away. There are some very good closed-end mutual funds, but they are not as popular as they used to be. The net asset value is a term that you really should learn, but you'll forget it, because nobody uses it unless you're in the industry. The net asset value is that number that when you go online or if you look at your statement, it's the current price of the mutual fund. And how do they do that? Well, they add up the value of the securities and they subtract any payments that they have to make, any liabilities, and that's usually very small, and then they divide by a number of shares. Open-end mutual funds are sold at net asset value. If there's a sales charge, they tack that on top of it. Since closed-end mutual funds are bought and sold on the open market, their price usually reflects either a premium or a discount, often a discount, to the net asset value, because they are being bought and sold in the marketplace. People are bidding for the price, people are asking for a certain price, and it might go above the net asset value, it might go below the net asset value. But open-end mutual funds, no. You buy directly from the mutual fund company, maybe through a broker, but you still go through the mutual fund company, and you buy at net asset value. And here's the formula. The book asks you to do a few problems. I don't care if you do them. I'm not asking you to learn this formula. It's not that hard. You take the value of the fund's portfolio and subtract out any liabilities. In other words, we have to pay somebody. When somebody's asked for some money, we have to pay them. We bought some securities, we have to buy those. But that's a small amount. And then you divide by the number of shares. So here's a mutual fund that has 10,050,000, nice round number, of shares of stocks or bonds. They owe $50,000 to somebody. Maybe somebody took a big redemption. So you subtract that out and you get 10 million. There are 1 million shares of the mutual fund out there, and that's NAV of $10. Every day that the market is open in New York, at the end of the day, the mutual fund company must compute the net asset value. And then you can look it up on the internet. They used to be published in the newspapers. They're not published in the newspapers anymore. Or you go to the mutual fund website. Make sense? Am I going too fast? Tedious, isn't it? They mean the same thing. Sales load, fund load, commission, sales charge. They all mean the same thing. If this fund had a 5% sales charge, sales load, sales commission, then you would buy it at $10.50. If it didn't have a sales charge, you'd buy it at $10. Make sense? Okay. Now, what are the advantages and disadvantages of open-end versus closed-end? Well, there are advantages and disadvantages of both. The open-end mutual fund has no market choices, no market forces, I'm sorry. You always get net asset value. And, of course, they're very popular. But from the standpoint of the mutual fund manager, this is not your problem. You're the investor. But from the people in the top hat, what happens if somebody comes in and buys a bunch of your shares? You all of a sudden now got a ton of new money to invest. Or worse, somebody comes in and starts unloading their shares, selling their shares. And this is what often happens when a mutual fund gets bad press, or you might have heard of Bill Gross. We'll talk about Bill Gross later on. He was the mutual fund manager for the world's largest mutual fund, the PIMCO Total Return Bond Fund, and he left PIMCO. They fired him, actually. And what happened? He is very popular, and people are now pulling their money out of the mutual fund. So it makes it difficult at times, not usually. There's a seat over here. It makes it difficult at times for the mutual fund to manage their resources. It's not your problem. It's their problem. And so what happens sometimes is the mutual fund company will close the fund. They'll say, we don't want any more money. We've got too much money. We don't know what to do with it. They'll close the fund. Closed-end investment companies, you have to pay the broker's commission. You have to pay your broker a commission. You got to buy them on the marketplace, so they might sell at NAV. They might sell at less than NAV. But from the standpoint of the management, think about it. Once you've issued all those shares, you don't have to worry about large redemptions or large purchases. You don't have to worry about what your investors are doing because they're talking to one another. They're buying the shares from one another. You simply concentrate on your investment. Make sense? People don't think about that. But it's something that you as you know, in the introduction to investments students should learn. And you'll forget after the end of the semester, and my apologies. But I want you to know, okay? So do study it. Now, there is a whole new type of mutual fund, which is barnstorming, taking the world by force, called ETFs, exchange-traded funds. And what they are is a hybrid of open-end and closed-end. They're an open-end fund so that there's no limit to the number of shares. Shares can be created, purchased when they're purchased, and redeemed. They can be destroyed when they're redeemed. But you don't go to the mutual fund company. You go to the stock exchange where they are traded. The investor must purchase the fund using a brokerage account. You incur the brokerage fund fees, the brokerage transaction fees, just as you did with the closed-end funds, but some very smart companies, you might have heard of Fidelity, you might have heard of Vanguard, they've opened up their own brokerage firms, and if you buy their ETFs, they ignore the commission. Do you understand? So it used to be that people say, well, you know, I don't really want to buy an ETF because every time I buy one, I have to pay my broker $12 and I got $50 a month away to put a month away. And Vanguard and Fidelity and a couple others, they said, oh, okay, let's open up our own brokerage firm. And if they buy our ETF, then that $50 a month won't be hit with a $12, $10, $9 fee. And so very, very smart. Very, very smart marketing. ETFs are becoming very popular, and we'll discuss why later on. So look at the ETF industry. It started around 1992, 93, but look at what's going on since I should go the other way, right, because I went the other one from past to the future. In 2006, there were 359. At the end of 2013... 1332. So how's that for growth, huh? And look at the number of billions of dollars. 423 in 2006. Almost 1,700 billion, $1.7 trillion. And it's growing fast. It is not, the growth is still going on. Make sense? You understand? Yes. The NAV?
Yeah.
What about it?
No, I'm speaking of the sales commission, NAV plus sales commission.
Right. If the fund has a sales load, they'll tack the sales load on top of the price. That's all it means. In other words, if this guy is selling for $10 and there's a 5% transaction fee, you pay $10.50, not $10. All right? How are we doing for time? Okay, good. Now, we said that the Investment Company Act of 1940 was a landmark piece of legislation. And it really was, folks. It defined what is called a regulated investment company. And this was something very new. They are often called pass-through investment vehicles. Don't tax us, IRS. We're making money, but we're not making it for ourselves. We're making it for our investors. And so the IRS, okay, I understand. So when you invest in the mutual fund, you're going to get a 1099, which is a document that says you made so much or lost so much. And then on your taxes, you pay whatever taxes you are due. The mutual fund simply passes through the investment returns to you. Make sense? It was a radical idea at the time. Now it's just we take it for granted. But it was a very, very good piece of legislation, and it's withheld the test of time. To qualify as a regulated investment company, a mutual fund, they must hold all their assets in stocks, bonds, and other traditional securities. They have a very limited ability to use derivatives or any other risky strategies. That is simply not allowed. There's a couple of derivatives that are allowed, but for the most part, you stay away from those scary things. They must use no more than 5% of their assets when acquiring any particular security. Now, what does that mean? If you're only allowed to take 5% of your assets and buy one stock, that means you have to have at least 20 stocks. Do you understand? Because 5 into 100 is 20. So in other words, you see what you're saying? Is we are encouraging you, we are requiring you to do diversification. It turns out that most mutual funds have more than 20 stocks. 100, 200, 300. But the idea is we're not going to let you not diversify. We want your investors to get that diversification. And they must create an organization which with what are called checks and balances. And this is the graph from your book. I would have turned it upside down, but they put the shareholders at the top. And the shareholders are represented by the board of directors. The board of directors' job is to make sure the mutual fund is run well, in the best interest of the mutual fund. Once you've taken Southwestern College off of your resume and you have Stanford and Brown and Carnegie and all these other universities on your resume, and you'll want to become one of these boards of directors. You want to be a person on the board of directors because they get treated very well, they get paid well, they get flown around the country. And there's a bit of controversy, a bit of criticism, that sometimes the board of directors are just a rubber stamp. Whatever the management company does is fine by them. They just rubber stamp it. That is true with some mutual fund companies, but not all. Their job, if they take it seriously, is to make sure they are looking out for you, the investor's best interest. And some do a very good job and some don't do. And it's not an easy job to do, by the way. The mutual fund itself, though, is made up of various parts. By far, the most important part are the people in the top hats. The investment advisor, the investment company. These are the people who make the buy and sell decisions. But do they actually buy or sell the stocks? No. Somebody else is actually holding on to the shares. The custodian. And somebody else is distributing the shares to the public. And somebody else is taking care of the processing of the customer orders to buy and sell shares. And then there's an independent public accounting agency. You might have heard of Ernst Young, Deloitte & Touche, KPMG. These are called the Big Eight. There used to be eight, now I think there's five. The big accounting firms. Their job is to go in there and audit everything and say, okay, you know, you say you have 100,000 shares of Microsoft. Where are they? Cool, here they are. The custodian has them. Now, why do you think they did this? Huh? Exactly. It's there to protect the shareholder. Checks and balances. It's there so that these people don't just disappear with the money. You got it? And what's cool is that some of these companies have specialized. There are companies that just do custodian services. And there are companies that just do the transfer for you. So it's pretty easy for an individual or not an individual, but some people to get together and create a management company and then plug in to the other companies that will do the other jobs for them. Part of the reason there's so many mutual funds, because you don't need a whole lot of money to get started. What you do need is to convince the public to buy your shares. That's the hard part. But that's the reason for the huge diversification of tasks to protect the public. And it's worked for the most part. And then the next two slides just go through what we just described. The mutual fund is a corporation run by the board of directors on behalf of the shareholders. The investment advisors are the people in the top hats who make the investment decisions. The distributors distribute the shares to the public. Often they do work with, they work a lot with brokers, stockbrokers, registered representatives, to say, hey, look, our mutual fund's really great. Would you sell it to your clients? The custodian is the company that holds onto the securities. Transfer agent keeps track of the purchases, certifies the fund's financial reports, is the job of the public accounting firm. Why the large diversification of tasks and companies? Well, mutual funds are highly regulated in order to protect shareholders' investment from fraud and collapse. How often have you heard of a scandal from a mutual fund company, right? Until 2003, you never heard. Wait a minute, Piano! Did you just say mutual fund scandals? You want me to invest in an industry that is plagued with scandal? Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. See, since 1940, the mutual fund industry has been regulated and escaped any hint of impropriety. Like that word, impropriety? Say impropriety.
Impropriety.
You know what it means? Hanky-panky. Right? Trucos, travesuras, shenanigans. There was one guy who had a small mutual fund, $4 million. He ran away. He was. It turns out he was an acquaintance of then President Richard Nixon back in 1970. He ran to Cuba with the $4 million. But he had some collusion. Yeah. No. In 2003, what happened is that there were some practices that were not illegal, but obviously unethical. And they were uncovered. And it was only a few funds, a few individuals, Strong, Janus, Bank of America funds, Putnam, poor George Putnam rolling around in his grave, Alliance, which is a pretty darn good mutual fund company. In fact, we're going to look at one of their funds. Two people at the firm were doing this, and the entire firm was tarnished by the reputation. Their reputation was tarnished, the entire firm. The vast majority of companies never engaged in any of these shenanigans. And what were they doing, folks? They were stealing pennies from people. Well, when you got a million investors, you know, stealing pennies can be lucrative. But probably the best example is Strong Fund. This guy, at the time this happened, he started his mutual fund from scratch. Richard Strong, or is it John? Richard Strong. And he built this thing up to the point where he was worth $600 million. Now, this is the real interesting case study. His shenanigans netted him about $80,000. Now, to you and me, is $80,000 a lot of money? But to somebody who's worth $600 million, is $80,000 a lot of money? So why did he do it? Knowing full well that he really shouldn't have been doing it. It wasn't illegal. He didn't go to jail. But he was barred from the industry for life. He had to divest all his investments in Strong Funds, which were eventually merged into another company. What would motivate somebody to do that? I really think that's interesting. I think that's an interesting case study in personal psychology. Because what happens when you get to this situation in life where, you know, you're on top of the world, people bow down to you, you think you're invincible. You think that the rules don't apply to you. And he apologized. He said, I ruined my life. I let down everybody around me. I don't know what I was doing. And what were they doing, folks? Well, I don't want to get into the details, but it turns out that if you're allowed, which mutual fund companies won't allow you to do this, you can buy and sell mutual funds day after day after day and juice your return. How does that work? Well, remember that the mutual fund company every day must compute the NAV. So that's 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time in New York, 1 o'clock our time. Well, what happens if the market tanks in the United States? Goes down a couple percent. Pretty much the case will be that a few hours later, when Japan and New Zealand and Australia open up their markets, they follow suit. It doesn't always happen, but it's almost like clockwork. You can watch it go around the world. And so what these people would do is they would sell their Japanese fund that day that the market tanks and then buy it back the next day. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Because the price is based on the price of the Japanese firms the day before. So they're selling high, expecting the Japanese firms to go down, and the Australian firms and the Hong Kong firms the next day, following suit with the United States, and then they buy it back. Now, what does this do? This increases costs for everybody else, because transaction costs, they cost money. And so they were stealing not even pennies from you, 0.01 pennies from people. But if you got 1 million shareholders, it adds up. So instead of losing $99,999.99 on a $100,000 account, example, Enron. Anybody remember Enron? The largest bankruptcy, but the company's been a couple of larger ones since then. Investors lost a penny. It's still theft, you understand? It's not right, but it wasn't the end of the world. And it was, as we said, only a few people. Any questions, any thoughts? You like that little story? Keep that in there? Okay, good. Now, because guess what, folks? We're ready to start something even more boring. And that is how we are being charged. Every mutual fund is charging you. And what is very important is that you're going to understand this. Because you're now the expert. You're now the expert. You're going to be in that 401k meeting with the three-piece suits telling you how wonderful a job they're doing for you. And you're going to blow the lid off of their little scheme that they got. And then they're going to look really stupid. And all your coworkers are going to say, "Where did you learn that?" And what are you going to tell them? Business 123. Come on. What are you going to tell them? Right, okay, good. Every mutual fund has annual operating expenses. And the three major categories are the management fees, the 12B1 fees. What a great name, huh? 12B1, goofballs. That's actually the code in the Investment Company Act that allows these things, that requires them. And then the accounting and other expenses. By far, the largest one normally is the management fee, because these are for the people in the top hats. And if they do it right, folks, it is not a cheap undertaking. If you're doing investment research correctly now, you're all around the world, because the world is global, you know, for good or ill. I think it's for the good, ultimately, but there are... nothing's perfect, and there are problems with it, but for the most part, I think it's good. And if you're doing this well, you've got to send these people who are highly paid to begin with all around the world, which ain't cheap, and so that you're paying for that. The 12B1 fees, on the other hand, are the fees that you're being charged for the servicing, for the marketing, for the distribution of the fund. Now, this is part of the Investment Company Act. Do most companies have to tell you how much they're charging you in the price of the product for the advertising? Does Budweiser tell you how much every can of beer is advertising? Or Nike? No, but mutual funds have to. Mutual funds have to tell you how much they're charging you for the advertising and servicing and distribution of the fund. And then the last one, that's for the accounting, for the rent, for the lights, for the janitor services, all the other things that have to be done. Now you notice there's a little line right here. If you have a Roth IRA, an educational savings account, a medical savings account, what the IRS calls a tax-qualified account, then there is an additional layer of bureaucracy. There is a trustee that is actually hanging on to your money. Don't worry, it's your money. They're not going to run away with it. But the trustee has to get paid, and they will typically charge you $10 a year. Up, I've seen it as high as 30. But that it's normally 10, 12 bucks a year. But that's only if it's a retirement account. If it's a Roth IRA, a simple IRA, traditional IRA. 401ks have their own sets of fees, and they often are more than this. But you don't normally deal with that. Plan administrator takes care of that. Okay, so these are the big three. If you remember that, great. If not, no big deal. But these three we want to key on. Now, the trading costs. Every mutual fund has trading costs because it costs money to buy and sell securities. They get a much better rate than you or I do when we have a brokerage account, but still it costs money. That is not required to be disclosed. So how would an investor know how much the trading costs are? Well, you can actually ask the mutual fund company. They will tell you. It's buried in the back of the annual report. But what you need to look at to make an easy comparison between mutual funds is the annual turnover. The annual turnover tells you how often they turn over the portfolio. If it were a 100% turnover, that means in 1 year they will have bought and sold everything in the account. A 50% turnover, 2 years. A 200% turnover, 6 months. You see that? See how that works? What I suggest to you, and what I look for, and that's just me, is a turnover rate of 20-25% for stocks. Some mutual funds have higher turnover rates just because, for example, a money market has a turnover rate of 300-400% because they're always buying and selling these in corporate paper because they're maturing in 30, 60, 90 days. So they have huge turnover. So that doesn't apply for a money market. But for bonds and stocks, we want to see a lower turnover rate. Not only because it will lower the trading costs, but also, to my mind, and again, everyone's different, that means they are investors and not speculators, not traders. Are you with me? If you see a mutual fund that has a 200% turnover, that means on average they're holding a stock for 6 months. That's not investing, in my humble opinion. Everybody's different. And everybody's entitled to my opinion as long as they agree. Everybody's entitled to their own opinion. But for me, I'm looking for 20-25%. If it's lower, great. But we'll see why that 20-25-30%. Because that means they're holding on to the stock for 4 years, 3, 4, 5 years. And when we get to stock picking later on, we'll see that a reasonable amount of time to hold on to a stock. Because that's about as far into the future as we dare guess to venture. Make sense? We'll come back to this later on. Okay. Now, the sales load. How are we doing for time? Not bad. Are you getting an education?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Good. Glad to hear that. Now, if I were to come up to you and say, you have a choice of paying a sales commission or not paying a sales commission, what would you say?
No.
I don't want to pay a sales commission, right? Well, it's not that easy. I wish it were, but it's not that easy. And you might decide to go with the no load, and you might decide to go with the load, because there are other factors involved. But the load is a charge that is put on top for when you buy the shares. Typically anywhere from 3 to 5%. And this is the traditional way that financial representatives, stockbrokers, the legal term is registered representative. If you go to the insurance industry, they'll sell you variable annuities. There are mutual funds. They'll have a sales charge. That was the traditional way that you compensated your financial advisor. It's changed. There are other flavors that we hope to get to today. The no-load fund is a mutual fund that does not charge a commission when shares are bought and sold. And you will hear an endless debate in the industry, in the media. There are people in the media who say, never buy a load fund. Don't you ever buy a load fund. And then when push comes to shove, they'll say, oh yeah, by the way, these load funds are actually pretty darn good. So it's an endless debate, and you're going to decide which one you want to go with. But the problem is the brokerage industries, the mutual fund industry, they're not stupid. They do their best to make it a little difficult, or a lot difficult, for you to understand the differences between these two entities. Now, I apologize, because some of you from the 121 class, you might remember this from last semester, and I always debate within myself about whether I should include it in the 121 class. I think it's really important, and they do a whole lot worse on the exam than you guys normally do, because they don't care at all. But for decades, the only type of mutual fund was a front-end load mutual fund, now usually referred to as Class A. Some companies call it Class 1, but normally you're going to see Class A. You pay an upfront fee when you buy the shares. Some of that goes to the mutual fund company. Some of it goes to your brokerage firm, and then your brokerage firm pays out the commission to the salesperson, the broker. They normally, but not always, will have lower annual operating expenses. The next one to come around were the back-end load. And back-end is pretty easy to remember because that's Class B. The back-end loads allow you to not be charged a fee when you buy the shares, but instead when you sell the shares. Now, you think people thought that was a cool idea? Well, what difference does it make if I buy the upfront fee or the back-end fee? You're still going to charge me you're still going to charge me a commission. Relax, sit down. With the back-end, we have what's called the Contingent Deferred Sales Charge, the CDSC. Now, I want you to say contingent. Doesn't it sound great when you say contingent? Doesn't it feel good in your throat? Contingent. You can feel your voice when contingent, especially if you have a bass voice, because I'm a tenor. And so what happens is that contingent deferred sales charge declines over time. It starts out at 5% or 6% or 4% and then goes down to 4%, 3%, 2%, 1%. Until after 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, depending on the mutual fund company, the contingent deferred sales charge, the back end sales charge, disappears. Normally, but not always, the B shares will have higher annual operating expenses. And what they do is they use the 12B1 fees, as we'll see. And eventually, most all companies revert the B shares to the A shares. The next category of load funds used to be called broker no-load funds. But you know what? The Securities and Exchange Commission does not allow them to call them no-load funds anymore. Because what they did is they amortized, which is a fancy way of saying stretched. They stretched the load out over 10 years or 8 years. And these are the Class C shares. No front-end load, no back-end load, maybe a 1% commission if you redeem the money within 1 year. But many Class C shares have higher annual operating expenses in perpetuity. Like that word? Perpetuity. You get to spit on your friends when you say it. Or for a very long time, 10 years, courtesy of the 12B1 fees. And hence, the Class C shares can wind up costing you more than the Class A shares or the B shares over time. The Securities and Exchange Commission now says you cannot have a mutual fund, you cannot call it a no-load fund, if the 12B1 fee is greater than 0.25. Wow, this is confusing. Is it confusing? Good, we've done our job. No, it's confusing, and you're going to have to go over it a couple of times. And some of the older brokers, they might get caught, because they changed this about, what, 6 years ago, 7 years ago? Some of the older brokers might still call it a broker no-load fund, but they're not supposed to anymore. So now those are the three types of load funds I want you to study. We're going to take a look at an example. We have enough time. Now for the no-load funds. We'll just look at two types of no-load funds. Advisor no-load funds. These go by various names. Class F, Class I, Class FI, Financial Advisor, Investment Advisor, Financial Investment Advisor. When you buy these advisor no-load funds, what happens is your broker puts the funds in what is often called a wrap account or a wealth management account. In that, you're going to get low annual operating expenses. You're not going to pay an upfront fee. You're not going to pay a back-end fee. But the broker is going to tack a fee on top of the fund. Typically, 1-2% of the fund will be paid every year to the broker. These are extremely lucrative for brokers, and they have been pushing these things for years now. I don't have anybody who has them, and I don't think they're in the best interest of the client. I wouldn't want one if I were an investor. And the last category are true no-load funds. And now, true is a term that the financial industry has added. That's not a legal term. Typically, the mutual fund company deals directly with the public. Have you heard of Vanguard? They advertise quite a bit. Have you heard of Fidelity? The Green Arrow? By the way, Fidelity has an entire class of advisor no-load funds to go along with their true no-load funds. But that does, just because you don't pay a commission, you don't pay a wrap fee, a wealth management fee, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're overall expenses are low. You got to look at those annual operating expenses. So now let's take a look. We got a few minutes. I know you can stay awake for a couple more minutes, right? Let's take a look, and when we come back, we'll start here. We'll review this very quickly. We'll start here. This is a real mutual fund. We're finally looking at something real, folks. It's been around in one form or another since 1926. Called Fundamental Investors. It was started by one of the people who started Merrill Lynch. And it has the A, B, C, and then the Class F. They actually have F1 and F2. Let's look at F2. Notice that you pay an upfront fee of 5.75%. So if you put in $100, how much is that? $5.75. Put in $50, it's $2.88. You put in $1,000, $57.50. You put in $10,000, $575. You put $100,000, no. Once you get above a certain amount, in this case $25,000, the sales charge starts to be reduced. And so finally, after you've accumulated or you've put in $1 million, you pay no sales charge. What do you think the industry's telling you? Yeah, give us more money. And we don't care about you little folks. If you got big bucks, we'll waive, not this wave, we'll waive the sales charge. And they're looking at increasing the amount of clients with ultra, they call them high net worth and ultra high net worth. But in perpetuity, you're going to be paying 25 cents for every $100 that you have in the account to the people in the top hats. You're going to be paying 24 cents for distribution, servicing, advertising of the fund. And you're going to be paying 14% for all the other fees, the accounting and the website and the management, rent and the like. And so that's 63 cents. So forever, as long as you own this fund, you're going to pay 63 cents for every $100 you have in the account. Does that sound like a lot of money? Well, by industry standards, that's on the low end. By industry standards, that's low. It is nowhere near as much as you will pay for your insurance investments or when you go to a bank. Is the insurance company required to tell you how much they're charging you every year? Everyone's going to say no. Wait until I ask you. Is the insurance company required to tell you how much they're No. Is the bank required to tell you how much they're charging you? No, but the mutual fund industry is required. And what they do is they show you in the prospectus, which we'll take a look at on Tuesday, and we will start right here with annual fees. We'll continue with fees and go through this. I wish you much success, lots of studying this weekend, right? No football, right? No, nothing to stop you from studying. If you came in late, please come see me and study and bring honor and glory to Southwestern Community College.